two respected human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch and the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, collaborated on a five-year investigative project starting in 1998, studying increasing trends of officialized and institutional homophobia in Southern Africa. This impressive study culminated with the production of the highly esteemed report, More Than a Name, State-Sponsored Homophobia and Its Consequences in Southern Africa. Principal in the report are its criticisms of Southern African leadership, notably Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, for his open contempt for lesbians and gays. This, in the context of attacks against Mugabe being commonplace among white colonialist interests for his land reform policies. Such is the complicated social and historical background for this ambitious report, authored by Scott Long of the IGLHRC, International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, and Whitney Brown of Human Rights Watch. To discuss the report, we're pleased to have these two activists here with us today on OutFM. Welcome, Whitney and Scott.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This report was initiated in response to a noted increase in policy-level anti-lesbian and gay positions taken by political leadership in Southern Africa. Would you like to go a little further into backgrounding the beginning of the study?
Well, I think it's probably an exaggeration, or it probably gives too much credit to these statements to say that they're policy level. What we've seen starting in the mid-1990s is that political leaders have started making really vituperative, just overwhelmingly intemperate attacks on lesbian and gay people as a political means. They have sensed in the context of economic collapse in many of these countries that their own political position was eroding, and to find a scapegoat became a means of shoring up their political position. In the process, lesbians and gays, who in many cases were virtually invisible in these societies, politically and socially invisible, were plunged into visibility in the worst possible way, identified not only as deviants, as un-African, as enemies of authentic culture, but as tools of foreign powers, as agents of neo-colonialist invasions. And the consequences in terms of discrimination, in terms of harassment, in terms of day-to-day violence have been overwhelming.
The report essentially traces the roots of the current homophobic trend to Robert Mugabe's reaction to the inclusion of the organization GALS, Gays and Lesbians of Zimbabwe, in the Zimbabwe International Book Fair in 1995. This took the form of vitriolic condemnation of lesbian and gay people as degenerates and so on. I'll read a brief quote from Mugabe, which appears in the report, in which he says that homosexuality, quote, degrades human dignity. It's unnatural, and there's no question ever of allowing these people to behave worse than dogs and pigs. Them's fighting words. The report goes on to quote Mugabe and other leaders openly condoning violence and police repression against queers. The contention is that Mugabe's unmitigated attacks on lesbian and gay people set an example which was followed by others.
Yes, I think that's true, and I think when you look at the Mugabe quote, the important thing to pick up is he says that recognition of gays and lesbians is an assault on human dignity, but in fact it is his assault on sexual minorities, lesbians, gay men, bisexual, and transgender and people in Southern Africa, and his assault on the very concept of equality of all people that is what undermines human dignity. And that's what it's so important to understand, that he has created a culture of intolerance whereby taking one of the most marginalized group in a society, he has made it acceptable to condemn and to carve out from the concept of human dignity and equality a minority. And having done that successfully with gays and lesbians, he then moved on to other members of his society, but the culture had already been accepted.
I was going to ask about the ways in which he has generalized this intolerance to his opponents, political opponents, human rights organizations, women's groups, etc.
Well, what we've seen in Zimbabwe over the last 7 or 8 years is a steady erosion of political freedoms and a steady erosion of a culture of rights. Zimbabwe 15 years ago had an independent judiciary. It had at least an open political system in which dissent was permitted and civil society had the space to organize. This has effectively disappeared under the pressure of Mugabe's government. And I think what we've seen, I think what is demonstrated by the Zimbabwean example, is that the situation of the most vulnerable, the most most marginalized groups in society, and gays and lesbians in many societies certainly qualify as that, is a barometer of the state of political freedom, of the future state of political freedom. Because, as Whitney said, if you can attack the most vulnerable, if you can attack the most despised with impunity, then you're creating a climate in which you can attack anyone, in which equality ceases to mean what it says.
The central theme in these attacks against homosexuality holds that queer lifestyles are essentially un-African, that they are an imported product of European and American moral frailty and degeneracy. Talk about that.
It's been a steady theme of the attacks throughout Southern Africa, and of course part of the paradox is that these attacks are enabled by, they defend sodomy laws, so-called sodomy laws, which penalize consensual adult homosexual behavior, and those laws themselves are a colonial imposition. Without exception, they were imposed by the colonial regimes. It's that homophobia inscribed in law which was imported from the colonial centers. I think what we see really is, again, the regimes attempting to shore up their own political support by identifying certain values in a completely synthetic way as being culturally authentic, as being historically pure. But that kind of search for historical purity, for a kind of imagined cultural purity, really has no place in politics, which should recognize the diversity of human beings and the diversity of desires.
Right, so it's ironic that while Mugabe accuses whites of importing homosexuality, a custom known to have existed in Africa before the arrival of the Europeans, in fact, while whites, what whites do seem to have imported is the puritanical colonialist constructs of the anti-sodomy legislation you're mentioning, which he employs and advocates currently. He's a very popular leader, Mugabe, in his own country, and enjoys considerable popularity among leftists in this country and around the world, while his critics, including this report, have suggested links between his scapegoating of queers and a perceived need to deflect criticism from his land reform tactics, which include dispossession of white landowners. His supporters counter that a generalized criticism of him based on a condemnation of his homophobic words and deeds chimes in with his colonialist detractors, who are invested in discrediting Mugabe and his politics. Has it been problematic for you that you could be seen to be in alignment with a colonialist perspective against Mugabe?
Well, we look at what his actions have meant for the people in Zimbabwe using a human rights framework. And a human rights framework says that if you are a state actor, if you are, in his case, you know, the leader of a country, it is his obligation to affirmatively protect and promote the rights of everyone in Zimbabwe, not just those people that he deems okay. And that the fact that he was, in fact, a hero to Zimbabweans, that Zimbabwe is, relatively speaking, fairly recently coming out from colonial power, cannot obscure the fact that he is turning around and abusing Zimbabweans in Zimbabwe. So I think that the criticism of "you're just chiming in with neocolonialism" ignores the fact that who is being harmed by his practices? It is poor black Zimbabwean men and women who are being harmed, not just by his homophobia, by his disastrous economic policies, by the corruption, by the shutdown of freedom of expression, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, by his attacks on women and other minorities, and by a catastrophic HIV/AIDS epidemic that he is not dealing with.
So you are taking a very strong position in a generalized way, in a contrary political position to Mugabe on more fronts than the queer issues that we're addressing here.
Right. I think the way that we've thought about it is the attacks on gays and lesbians is a human rights violation in and of itself that deserves to be documented as such. But in the particular context of Zimbabwe and also Namibia, you have to understand how it's been used as a political tool, a platform from which he then reaches out and attacks others. And so we want to make both a very clear point that any attack on gays and lesbians that undermines their dignity and strips them of equality is a human rights violation that we must speak out against. But we also have to understand how that's used in a very political way, in a way that puts the rights of the other Zimbabwean people at risk, and that we have seen that progression in that way.
Do you find it ironic that Mbeki of South Africa enjoys a comparatively positive image in Western media and government attitude, even though many more people have died in South Africa after apartheid and attacks against white landowners than in Zimbabwe, and even though, according to More Than a Name, public attitudes against lesbians and gays are scarcely better in South Africa than in the rest of Southern Africa, even with the Equality Clause.
Well, first of all, I mean, I don't think it's simply a question of supporting Mbeki or opposing Mbeki or supporting Mugabe or opposing Mugabe. It's a question of defending human rights and political freedoms. And I think the issue in Zimbabwe is not, you know, Mugabe as a person or even the Mugabe government per se, but its policies of restricting freedom in the public sphere. Land reform is a good thing carried out by legal means. The question is who benefits from land reform, and simply to take land away from people who have it is only one half of the equation. Giving it to people who don't is the other half, and the real failure of the Mugabe government has been in distributing land not to landless black laborers, but to supporters of the ZANU-PF regime. It's not going into the hands of people who need it most. Now, I think what we do see in South Africa, and we have criticized the Mbeki government for its inaction in implementing the Equality Clause and in working against the degree of homophobia which still exists in society and culture. But what you still see in South Africa is a government, a state that's committed to the rule of law, that protects political freedoms, and that protects the sphere in which people can advocate for their equality to be made real. And, you know, that is still happening in South Africa. There's still civil society advocacy and agitation for getting the equality that's promised in the Constitution. It's an enormous achievement in South Africa that those constitutional protections and promises are there. The battle is to make them real, to make them universal, to make them meaningful.
Mbeki, the HIV-AIDS denialist at the regional epicenter of the epidemic, seems to personify the causal connections made in Africa as they've been made in the U.S. and Europe between queer lifestyles and HIV transmission. Queers and HIV-positive people are stigmatized bilaterally, and real protection information such as safe sex information and the like is suppressed. Would you care to expand on that?
Well, I actually think that the issue of HIV in Southern Africa, which just has a pandemic beyond any pandemic we've ever seen throughout history, is more complex than what we saw in the U.S. because it's about a question of gender equality, sexual rights, and information and misinformation or disinformation. And I think that one of the connections that we try to make in the report is to say that a government cannot credibly claim that it is committed to ensuring that accurate information on how to protect yourself from HIV, or that it is being truly accurate when it says it wants to protect people who are living with HIV/AIDS from discrimination or persecution, that you have to do that in the context of recognizing and respecting people's sexuality, including women's sexuality. And you have women in Southern Africa who are incredibly disempowered in their ability to control their own sexual expression and relationships. And the whole, and I think very much you see the way that sexual minorities and discrimination against women really intersect here, because in both cases what you have is a patriarchal system that wants to control and police sexuality, whether it's women's sexuality or queer sexuality. And the policing is itself inherently violent. South Africa has one of the highest rates of sexual violence of a country not in conflict. And the lesbians that we interviewed said across the board they live with a daily threat of sexual violence. You cannot on the one hand say that you take the fight against HIV/AIDS seriously and at the other hand create a culture in which you basically allow attitudes in which people get the message that you can police women and sexual minorities' sexuality, knowing that one of the forms it will take is sexual violence.
There are, if I could add, I think there are two factors that are really intertwined in Southern Africa. There's violence and silence as contributing factors in the HIV epidemic. And the violence reinforces the silence, and the silence allows the violence to take place. One thing that really startled me in doing this research was the number of gay men who reported that they, or other gay men, or men who were having sex with men, believed that having sex with men was safer, almost conferred an immunity from HIV because the image of the epidemic is so profoundly heterosexual, and because there's been no discussion of homosexual transmission or of homosexuality in general. And that is a real testimony to the way in which governments are enforcing silence and are enforcing ignorance. And it's true in Southern Africa, as anywhere else, that that kind of silence equals death.
But the report notes that legislatively things are better in South Africa, where the important Equality Clause was enacted in 1996 with the new South African Constitution, the first national constitution to expressly forbid discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and to expressly support diversity in various other forms as well. The Equality Clause has since been upheld in numerous important legal precedents, including striking down sodomy laws, protecting same-sex partners' rights to medical coverage, residence permits, survivors' pensions, as well as couples' parental rights and post-separation custody rights. It would seem that the social climate would have to be some better in South Africa than elsewhere in Southern Africa, no?
That's true, and I think it's important to recognize that the Equality Clause came out of the ANC's experience of really fighting apartheid, where they understood how devastating discrimination is. And so the Equality Clause was the first time that a constitution in any in any state, any country, had included protection from discrimination based on sexual orientation, and that's a huge step forward. I think what we're seeing now, though, is that for the people who's you mentioned a bunch of cases, and those are basically brought by fairly privileged gay and lesbian South Africans, we spend a lot of time doing research in the townships in rural areas where people live in just devastating poverty. And for the young black men and women that we interviewed, this Equality Clause has had no reality for them. They're still being excluded by their families, kicked out of schools, can't get a job, facing threats of violence all the time. And I think one of our recommendations to the South African government is to do education on the content of the Constitution, not merely the Equality Clause, but the content of, because it's an amazing constitution for all South Africans, and then to set up a mechanism other than going through litigation, which is quite expensive and time-consuming, where they can file complaints and get some access to some remedies. And then the other thing that we've really called on is for the leadership of South Africa to own this issue. Nobody stepped forward who's in the government and said, we believe in the Equality Clause, we want to make it real for everyone. And so right now it's a fragile dream, and when you interview South Africans, they are justifiably proud of the Equality Clause, and they have every reason to be. But what we don't want to see is it remain abstract. We need to see it real in people's lives.
Now that sodomy laws have been struck down in the States also, which happened after the completion of this report, do you think that the South African example has influenced events here? And do you expect the American change to reflect back on legal attitudes elsewhere in Southern Africa?
Well, the interesting thing about the Supreme Court case striking down the sodomy laws is, generally speaking, when you read Supreme Court decisions, they do not cite international law or practices outside the U.S. And in fact, in the majority's opinions, they cite both the European Union example of as a criteria of admission to the European Union. All the governments that want to be a part of that must get rid of their sodomy laws, and also cited South Africa. So it's a very interesting precedent where I think precisely because there wasn't much here internally, the justices actually looked overseas for good precedents to follow.
Interesting. Your report mentions insinuations and even direct threats against American and European lesbian and gay people traveling in Zimbabwe and Namibia. Do you know of instances of anything happening along these lines?
I don't know of cases where those threats have been carried through. I think, you know, the predominant victims of state-sponsored homophobia and the predominant victims of violence are residents of the country, are mostly poor, disempowered black lesbians and gays. I'll tell you a story, which I think is rather typical, that I believe 3 years ago, President Mugabe was in London, and a British gay activist staged a citizen's arrest and detained Mugabe physically, charging him not only with promoting violence against gay people in South Africa, but with also participating in genocide against the Ndebele people during civil unrest in the 1980s. And almost the next day, a 16-year-old black gay man in Harare, Zimbabwe, was sitting in a cafe on a Sunday morning wearing a scarf which had a pattern which looked vaguely like a British flag. And officers of the Central Intelligence Department, who were basically Mugabe's elite guard, came across him, saw that he looked effeminate, seized him, took him and a friend off in a car, and beat him within an inch of his life. That's the kind of direct relationship between the president's insecurities, the government's fears, and what actually happens to the bodies of people who are on the line.
Yeah, you mentioned in the report that proof of conduct is not necessary for prosecution particularly in Zimbabwe, and that even it gets extended to just personal attire, which then broaches a freedom of expression issue.
Yeah, the whole sort of construction of homosexuality or identity is sort of a fascinating issue for us in this report, because the first thing is to understand that construction of identity is something that happens in very specific ways in very specific cultures, and that what you have with the police when they're abusing their power and attacking gays and lesbians is they're importing the Western construction of sexual orientation or homosexuality based on earrings, on mannerisms, on type of build. I mean, the women who I interviewed who got harassed, it's because they had short hair, they wore pants. So they're importing this whole construction that does not actually resonate by and large with many of the women and men that we spoke with.
Whitney and Scott, thanks very much for your work on this fine report, More Than a Name. Thanks very much for talking to us on Out FM.